You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
A recently released report to the Associate Minister of Transport, James Meagher, outlined progress on the resilience and security of New Zealand's critical underwater infrastructure. The heavily redacted 9-page report detailed 10 no-cost, low-effort options to mitigate vulnerabilities to undersea cables and to improve ways of working with industry and regional partners. And while the incidents of cable faults that the report pointed to were typically accidents or related to currents and seismic activity, a particular impetus for the report was the growing threat to critical underwater infrastructure internationally. With 99% of our international internet coming through just 5 cables, their importance to our day-to-day lives is difficult to understate. So, to discuss the report and the importance of the undersea cables connecting New Zealand to the rest of the world, I spoke to Dr. Ulrich Speidel from the School of Computer Science at the University of Auckland. Kia ora, Dr. Ulrich Speidel. So, starting off, as someone who grew up with the absolute terror of the Auckland Museum volcano room, showing the devastation that Rangitoto erupting would unleash, can you just paint for us the kind of similar devastation that we would see if the undersea cables that connect us internationally to the internet, what would happen if they were cut?
Kia ora, Theo, and thank you for having me. So, basically the first thing I would say is that when we're looking at our international cables, so we've got two cables running from Auckland's west coast over to Australia, and then we've got three cables running from other spots in the North Island. So there's two that are running off Takapuna, and then there's another one that's running off Mangawhai. And those latter ones, they all go to the United States, either to Hawaii or to the U.S. West Coast. And these ones could actually break much, much further away than Rangitoto. I mean, you know, obviously the Auckland volcanic field is of some concern in that respect, but thing is, when these cables actually run up to the United States, you know, or to Hawaii, so West Coast or Hawaii generally, then they run an absolute gauntlet of volcanoes on the way up, and that's the more likely place where they might get interrupted. And then, of course, you know, there's always the risk of human interference with cables, you know, be that deliberate or accidental, has happened and is happening, you know, on an almost weekly basis around the world, depending on where you are. So in the shipping lanes of Singapore, for example, it's quite common for cables to get damaged. And of course, the Europeans are very, very concerned about the cable damage out in the Baltic Sea at the moment, where the Russian shadow fleet seems to have developed a bit of a habit of anchor dragging. But what would that look like? What we would probably see is the loss, at least temporary loss of some services until the routing gets sorted out again, and how quickly they can get sorted out is probably a function of what else is happening. So whether we're dealing, you know, say for example, with a major volcanic eruption or tsunami locally or earthquake locally or something like this, or whether it's an event that's a bit further afield that's not really affecting anyone here.
Right. So, I mean, that kind of touches on one of the big sort of impetuses of the still pretty heavily redacted progress report on the resilience and security of our critical underwater infrastructure, where what was seen as an increasing threat of undersea cables intentionally being cut. Given that this is a physical threat and New Zealand seems so far away from most countries, do you think that this is particularly high up on that kind of bad actor threat list? Or are, for example, like more remote attacks on our infrastructure, so like cyber attacks, a bit more likely?
Right. I mean, it depends on what you're looking at. So if you're looking at, for example, spying attacks, it's usually easier to get into the shore-based infrastructure and attack that, basically trying to, splice yourself with a tap into a fiber cable at, 5,000 meters under the ocean. That is not really something that's overly trivial or overly easily done, especially not without anyone noticing, actually hacking into about siphoning off traffic from there is generally the sort of approach that intelligence services tend to use. I mean, you know, that all said, one of the things, of course, we might think we're far away from everything here, but one of the things, of course, that we are here, we are a transit point between Australia and the United States for data. So especially with the Southern Cross and, you know, to an extent with the Southern Cross Next cable, we are at least an alternative pathway for Australian, you know, traffic to the US and, you know, US traffic going to Australia. And so that, in some respects, probably makes us an attractive target for sabotage. But at the same time, you know, we, you know, because we have a relatively large number of cables, I mean, one of the sort of names of the game of damaging people's cables is that you kind of need to maintain plausible deniability. And if you have a place that's got maybe one or two cables going in and out, and these happen to be getting damaged at the same time and nobody really knows why, well, then you can kind of sort of, you know, I guess say, well, you know, I don't know nothing about this. But, you know, in our case, you know, with five cables going out of the country, if they all got damaged at the same time, that would probably no longer be a case of for plausible deniability. I mean, you know, that said, you know, we have a natural suspect that might be damaged, able to damage our, you know, two most modern cables, and that's a volcanic island up in Tonga that might go off. So it's not just the sort of political threat. There's actually quite a little bit of natural hazard threats along the lines as well. And, you know, as we've seen, for example, with the Tongan cable break in 2022 after the Hunga-Tonga-Hapai eruption. So you know, took Tonga offline for an entire month, pretty much. But, you know, of course, they took them offline because they only had a single cable. Now we've got five, and so we're actually in a relatively good position in that respect. Our risk is more that if something happens here, that it happens in a point where it would either affect multiple cables. So Auckland volcanic eruption, you know, is a, you know, fairly good example for that. But also, you know, you might be in a situation for, you know, where, for example, when the Tongan island explodes, you know, two of the more modern cables go away, and at that point that would probably require a wee bit of rerouting of traffic, and, you know, with the complex and complicated arrangements between various providers, various ISPs and so on, that can potentially take a few days. And if those are days in which you're trying to recover or do damage limitation from a natural disaster or something like this, then at that point, obviously, that's a major stumbling stone.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, the report itself said that the industry partners mentioned how if one of the cables were brought down, we probably wouldn't really have any noticeable impacts as the capacity could be shifted to the other four. Now, we've got two more in the pipeline, if you excuse the pun. Do we need these extra cables for reasons other than just that kind of like backup option sort of capability, or are we really increasing the amount of data that we're sending through these and they're needed for that added capacity?
Well, there's more than one answer to this. So you've probably heard about this new data center that's being, you know, planned for the South Island. So a lot of that sort of being marketed as, you know, giving New Zealanders better access to artificial intelligence and all this sort of stuff. But really, at the end of the day, what it's doing, it's probably going to be providing mostly artificial intelligence services to Australia. And so one of the reasons why they're needing, you know, a cable down there is, you know, obviously in order to be able to get the training data, you know, which would be coming from Australia, over to their data center, which would then be, you know, running the sort of big GPU-based you know, servers that would you know, be running all those you know, very large AI models. But at the same time, you know, it does obviously, you know, also help with redundancy on the existing sort of network that we've got, especially around the South Island, you know, which is not as redundantly connected as the North Island is, because I mean, all of our international cables at the moment, for example, land on the North Island. So, you know, that obviously means that, you know, whatever, you know, connects to South Island, and at the moment that's, you know, essentially a couple of cables and, you know, and a radio link. This is not as strong, you know, a connection as, you know, the, you know, and not as diverse a connection as the North Island to Australia or North Island to the United States segments are. So those things are actually quite useful. I mean, in terms of other cables, the other you know, argument, I guess, that, you know, one always makes is, well, you know, it introduces competition to the market, and those cable systems, to a large extent, do actually, you know, compete with each other in the sense that, you know, they're offering, you know, extra capacity here, extra capacity there, and it allows more players to enter the market. So in terms of competition, that's probably not a bad thing, and, you know, in terms of resilience, you know, it's also probably not a bad thing.
I was a bit surprised to note that the cables provide 99% of our internet in New Zealand, which is a crazy amount of data going through those cables. In the future, do you think that we'd see an increasing shift to satellites providing that, or is the capacity provided by undersea cables just in a completely different league to them?
I would say it's the latter. It's they're simply in a completely different league. I mean, basically, when you want to upgrade the capacity on a fiber optic cable, what you generally do is you upgrade the endpoint interfaces. You don't go and lay a new cable. So, for example, you know, the Southern Cross cable that was laid in the mid-1990s, you know, that's still serving us very, very nicely here, and that got upgraded in capacity a number of times over its lifetime. You know, I'm expecting, you know, similar, you know, technical progress to lead to upgrades along the other cables if and when that's needed and commercially viable. In terms of satellites, the problem that you have with satellites really is that they need to uplink and they need to downlink their data, and in that respect, they need to go through essentially a resource bottleneck in terms of the frequencies that are available for this, and there's also a power bottleneck on the side of the satellite, which means that satellite cannot projects unlimited amounts of power towards the Earth, simply because, you know, at some point it just gets gets limited by the amount of solar panel array that the satellite can carry. And also the other problem that we're having, you know, with satellites, obviously at the moment, is really only one satellite network that's carrying any significant amount, you know, or large amount of data, and that's Starlink. And you know, we know pretty much you know, fairly well where Starlink's limitations are, and you know, the you know, entire Starlink capacity that you're looking at, you know, from, you know, say, you know, Auckland for argument's sake, when you're looking up into the sky, and it's now in the vicinity of about 50, 60 satellites that they've got up there. And if you put all of them together, because they're all competing for the same piece of spectrum, when they're downlinking the data to us, basically we're not in a position, you know, to even compare that to a cable. It's, you know, we're talking, you know, under 100 gigabits per second, you know, even with a new, well, under 100 gigabits per second, even with the new FCC rules. And so the thing that's important to note there is that even if they launch more satellites, that bottleneck's not going to change. So at the end of the day, what we're going to end up with, you know, is an undersea resource that's, you know, kind of growing as technology grows, and you know, a space-based resource that's not really having quite that same growth potential. And, you know, I mean, 100 gigabits per second, if you think about it, I mean, these days, if you're, you know, going and ordering a fiber connection for your home, well, that's almost a gigabit per second in most cases. So, you know, literally a single suburb these days has more connectivity capacity than, you know, the whole of Auckland will be getting from space. And that's the kind of limitation that we're seeing there.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Ulrich Speidel on the recently released government report on our critical underwater infrastructure and the importance of our undersea cable network.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.